Caris to join it somehow, and Corvin to see if he could find some way to exact vengeance. It was a risk to trust Corvin Danevis, of all people, but he had saved Caris, and his reputation from the war was sterling. Truth was, it was more dangerous to travel alone. They'd been following King Caradhul's army south for days, and not once had he put out scouts. He'd seemed so careless that now Caris and Corvin had walked right past a scout in a tree stand. As they stood at the edge of a wood, half a league behind the rear guard, the scout was sprinting to the east down a slight hill, rather than going straight for the rear guard.
"She'll have a horse down in the gully there. You might be able to cut her off," Corvin said.
He was unslinging his great yew bow.
"Shot's too far, but I might get lucky."
Caris was already running. Away from the Umber River, Tyria had rapidly become a scrub-brush desert. In a few spots fed by underground springs, there were clumps of pine trees like the one she and Corvin had just left, but for the most part this land was rolling hills, often broken, something between a desert and a badland. It had made their pursuit of King Haradul's army more and more difficult, because even though they were travelling by foot and thus didn't kick up the huge quantities of dust that Haradul's men and wagons did, they still could be seen. They had to decide at every hill whether they should go straight over and risk being seen, or go around and lose even more ground. An army didn't travel fast, but it did travel straight. The scout was a good 200 paces in front of Caris, judging from the slight slope of the hill, and making a guess, Caris angled off to the right. Probably the scout would make it to her horse, but if Caris were within 100 paces when the scout mounted, she wouldn't be mounted for long. Something dove out of the sky and pierced the ground not 5 paces behind the fleeing scout. She didn't even notice.
Damn!
Corvin had nearly hit a sprinting target at 250 paces. That close, and he couldn't have gotten just a little closer. The woman turned and angled more to the right. Corvin's second arrow missed by a good 15 paces, flying where she might have been if she'd run straight. Caris barreled on, heedless of the ground, hurdling tumbleweed and praying that she not step on the infrequent tough cactus that grew so low to the ground here that you never saw it until its spines stabbed through your shoes. And that wasn't as bad as the rattling snakes. At the speed Caris was running, of course, there would be no warning rattle, just a strike. She pushed harder. Maybe if she ran fast enough, even a striking snake might miss her. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Corvin's next arrow streak into view. The shot was more than 300 paces, now albeit with no wind, so Corvin was having to shoot halfway between the horizon and vertical, simply for the arrows to make the distance. But this shot looked perfect. It dove, and the scout crashed into the ground, full speed. Caris couldn't believe her eyes. An impossible shot. 300 paces at a running target? She cut left, heading straight for the woman. Almost as soon as Caris turned, she saw Corvin's arrow sticking out of the ground back where the scout had fallen. It hadn't impaled her. It had tripped her. Even as Caris saw it, she saw the woman standing, her head swiveling toward Caris. She looked shaken, her palms bloody, a cut down the side of her face, but the woman started running regardless. Caris had easily covered 100 of the 200 paces between them, and as the scout had to go from a dead stop to sprinting, Caris made up more than half of that. She wasn't even 30 paces back. No more arrows fell. They were out almost 400 paces now. Even with a yew longbow, this was an extreme distance. There was no way Corvin would risk an errant shot with Caris so close to their quarry. Caris fumbled with her necklace, trying to grab her eye caps. Even breaking stride that much gave the scout an edge, and she pulled away. Curse her! The woman ran like an antelope. But with the patience born of experience, Caris let her take the extra distance. Once she got the green and red eye caps on, the fight was over. She cracked apart the appropriate link of her necklace, watching the ground in front of her, ripped the luxin off, and slowed for a few steps to get the caps stuck perfectly around each eye socket. The scout cut hard left as the hill descended rapidly, shouting. Caris came after her, filling her right arm with red luxin and her left with green as she ran. The scout was shouting. To whom? Maybe she was shouting to her horse. Sure she is, Caris. In an instant, Caris was over the hill and barreling down the steep path straight into a camp. There were 12 men waiting for her, at least 2 with nets, 2 with catch poles, cudgels, staves, swords sheathed, not wanting to kill, but capture. A trap. Caris felt sick horror. the shot like a fist in her gut. Like she was 16 again, her father dragging her to a boat, sailing away from Big Jasper. Her father's boat had sailed past the family mansion, where she'd secretly, she thought, agreed to meet Dazen. Her brothers were there, lying in wait. They'd said they were going to teach Dazen a lesson for trying to destroy their family. But she'd seen murder in their eyes. She had been standing on the deck when an explosion had blown out all the windows of her room on the second floor of the mansion. She saw figures limned in fire, fighting. Something ripped off half the roof, and explosion followed explosion. Bodies were hurled 100 paces out into the water. Standing next to her on deck, her father paled.
"You said he was coming alone, you stupid slut! Look what you've done! He must have brought an army!"
Her father didn't strike her, just grabbed her head and made her watch what she couldn't have torn her eyes away from if she tried. In minutes, the only home she'd ever known was engulfed in flames. She'd been a child then. She'd been unable to think, unable to act. She wasn't a child any longer, and she had pools of rage to draw from that innocent hadn't known. Caris used the height disparity of coming down the steep trail to leap at the first of the two horsemen who were side by side. He was holding a catch pole in both hands, and he brought it up sideways, trying to block. He caught her extended foot, but she just let her kick collapse and slammed into him with both knees. Ribs crunched as she swept him out of his saddle. She rolled as she hit the ground, but had to catch herself with her right hand, which was holding her narrow ataghan, so she drafted a thin blade of green luxin from her left hand as she passed under the second horse. The blade passed through its belly easily. Caris was on her feet before the horse even reared in pain. She let the green luxin disintegrate as she charged one of the net men, switching her sword to her left hand. He was too stunned. He didn't move, not even as she lunged full length, stabbing at his face, her right hand flinging a weak arc of fire behind her for distraction. The net man still didn't move, and her lunge connected. The blade caught him between the eyes, skidded off the bone, and dove deep through his eye. Turning to follow the arc of fire she'd thrown, Caris saw a weighted net spinning toward her just as the arc of fire faded from the air. Perfect throw. But she waited. Waited, switching sword hands again, until the net was between her and a man swinging a staff overhead at her. With a snapping pop-pop, Caris shot out 2 horseshoes of green luxin. One whistled harmlessly through the twisting, expanding net, but though it missed the net, the horseshoe did catch the staff swinger in the cheek, blasting him off balance. The second horseshoe snagged the net as it passed through and whipped it back into several men, its leaden weights suddenly becoming a flail. The horse was rearing now, screaming in pain, a hideous sound, its entrails spurted out in a bloody, ropey mass. But Caris barely heard it, barely saw it. She saw only chaos, and chaos was her friend. Chaos was her advantage when fighting these odds. Men were falling away from her on every side. Caris flung little balls of fire at the tents nearest her, blocking her view. Curse being short. Where was the man shouting orders? The tents went up in flames, but it didn't seem to faze anyone but Caris. Everyone was fleeing. She was just beginning to get a sense of how many men were in this camp. There were dozens of tents. Maybe 100 men? Oh, Hollum, she had to get out. Then she heard a thunderous roar. The ground around her feet jumped into the air as musket balls struck and the concussion of their fire rolled over her. She looked up and saw a wide half-circle of musketeers, at least 40 of them. Half were reloading in smooth, practiced motions, unhurried, well-trained. The other half had their muskets, still loaded, trained on Caris.
"The next volley takes your life, Caris White Oak," a man shouted.
He was lean, mounted, wearing rich garments that announced he was King Rask Haradul, if the smug expression on his face hadn't.
"The sword and the luxin, now," he said.
Caris looked at the semicircle of blasted dirt in front of her, trying to gauge the accuracy of the king's musketeers. Pretty damn good. They were only 20 paces away. It would take a miracle. King Haradul's armour was, of course, mirrored, and he had mirror men and drafters to his left and right. What about Corvin? If Corvin ran as fast as she had, he might get here at any time. Carys always lost track of time once fighting started. Maybe he'd already seen what she had gotten into. Either way, not even he could do anything against these odds. He certainly couldn't save Carys from 20 musketeers with an easy shot at her. Carys pulled off her eye caps and dropped them, and threw her sword away, and let the green and red dribble from her fingertips. Usually, when she let the Luxin go, she felt less wild, less angry. Not this time. "Galen," King Haradul said, gesturing to someone behind her. Carys was starting to turn when something heavy cracked her over the head. Chapter 43 Kip followed Commander Ironfist up another flight of steps, which disgorged them in front of the biggest double doors Kip had ever seen. The doors were a slightly smoky glass, filled with slow waves of every hue, a great lake of colour. Commander Ironfist lifted one great silver knocker and pounded it onto the door three times. It was as if he'd thrown three rocks into a pond of light. Though the door itself didn't move, the light within it cratered and threw ripples out in every direction. It took Kip's breath away. He put a hand on the door, and where his fingers touched, tiny ripples formed.
"Don't touch!" Ironfist barked.
Kip pulled back his hand as if burned.
"There are a few things you need to know before you go in, Kip," Ironfist said. "First, it's all real. We lose one out of every 10 supplicants."
"Lose as in?"
"They die. Second, you can make it stop whenever you want. There will be a rope put in your hand. Pull the rope and it will ring a bell. They'll stop immediately. Third, if you quit, you're finished. You can't stay. It costs a lot of money for a satrap to maintain a drafter, and not one of them will waste money on a coward. Gavin has instructed me that should you fail, I'm to give you enough silver to buy a small farm and put you on a ship to the destination of your choice. It's better than most failures get, but you'll not be allowed to return here ever again. You're a shame enough as it is."
Apparently, tact wasn't part of the test.
"I'm shameful?"
Kip asked, a lump rising in his throat. Gavin hadn't treated him like that. Ironfist blinked.
"The life of a drafter is hard and short. I don't have time for lies, no matter how comforting. You're a bastard. That's a common enough shame for a great man, but it's a shame nonetheless. Anyone who can do simple arithmetic will know that you were sired while the Prism was betrothed to Carys Whiteoak, a woman most of us hold in high regard. Prisms are held to a higher standard, so you're a greater shame than usual. Even if you're excellent in every regard, you'll be a shame. If you're a failure, it's worse. That's the truth. Dressing it up in silk and lace isn't going to change it. Now, fourth, they say Orholm himself watches every initiation. Failing means failing him, farm boy. Ready?"
If Kip failed, he'd be put off the island. Not only would he shame the man who'd saved his life, but he would lose his only chance for retribution on the man who'd taken his mother's. Kip wasn't going to fail. He'd die first. Ironfist saw the look on his face.
"Good."
The great doors in front of Kip rippled once more, the molten, iridescent hues undulating gently and then seeming to spill left and right. It was as if something huge were surfacing from unimaginable depths. Kip's heart seized as a great face appeared, so fast he couldn't even comprehend all the details, just white hair, eyes like stars, and water of every shade bursting away from his features as he burst free, and opened his mouth, a yawning cavern of blackness that overwhelmed the doors. Kip flinched as it seemed the mouth would swallow him. The doors burst open from within as if a giant had smashed them. A gust of air rushed over Kip.
"Enter!"
Ironfist commanded. Kip walked in alone to a round chamber. The walls and floor were the same smoky clear crystal as the door. Seven figures stood in a crescent around a black disc inlaid in the floor. Kip hesitated, and none of them moved. No one told him where to go. The figures were robed, one for each color. The superviolet wore violet robes, and subred wore deep red robes, for the benefit of those who couldn't see into their spectra. But as Kip widened and then tightened his eyes, he saw that the sub-red was indeed radiating heat, and the superviolet was clad in his colour, hard pieces of superviolet luxin hooked together like rings of mail. Still uncertain, Kip walked toward them. As he got closer, he could see beneath their hoods. His fists balled. The sub-red had blackened skin. No eyebrows. No hair. Little flame wisps escaped from its head. The green's face was gnarled as an old oak, its eyebrows like moss, hair strung with lichen. The blue looked like cut glass, features either smoothed out to planes or sharpened to jewel-like points. Dear Orholm, were these all color whites? Then, from within his sleek goo, the orange blinked. Kip noticed the eyes. All of their eyes. These were drafters in masks and makeup. They represented the whites of each color. Seven different varieties of death and dishonor. Kip started breathing again, though he couldn't control a little tremble. He stepped onto the black disk facing them.
I am Anat. I am Roth, the sub-red said. I am consumed with rage.
I am Dagnu. I am gluttony, the red said. I can never be filled.
I am Moloch. I am greed, the orange said. I can never be satisfied.
I am Belphego. I am sloth, the yellow said. I withhold my talents.
I am Atarat. I am lust, the green said. I desire ever more.
I am Mott. I am envy, the blue said. I cannot bear others' good fortune.
I am Ferelax. I am pride, the superviolet said. I would usurp Orholm's own throne.
They were the names of the old gods. Kip had barely even heard of them.
These are the distortions of our nature, the temptations of power.
The voices spoke out in turn, smoothly, overlapping, like one consciousness.
For without mastery of ourselves, we become monsters, shameful and ashamed, hiding in the darkness. But we are the sons and daughters of Orholm.
We are Orholm's gift, expressions of his love,
his law,
his mercy, his truth.
Thus we stand unashamed, clothed in his righteousness.
The sub-red stepped forward, pulled off his mask and stepped out of his robe. He was a young man, muscular, handsome, and naked.
Casting off wrath, I am patient, the sub-red said.
He lifted his hands, and even without looking into the sub-red, it was clear that he was drafting. The air shimmered with heat around his whole body.
Orholm's will be done.
The red stepped forward, pulled off her mask and stepped out of her robe. She was young, athletic, beautiful, and also naked. Kip's eyes widened. He tried to hold them to her face.
Somber ceremony, Kip. Orholm's watching, Kip. Straight to hell, Kip.
Casting off gluttony, I am temperance,
the red said. She lifted her hands, and red luxin blossomed through her entire body, eyes, face, down her neck to her breasts, nipples, firm, tight stomach, breasts, nipples.
Kip!
In an instant she was like a statue, every bit of her skin dyed a perfect red.
Orholm's will be done, she said.
The orange stepped forward, a man, mercifully.
Casting off greed, I am charity, he said. Lifting his hands he turned a gleaming orange. Orholm's will be done.
Yellow said, casting off sloth, I am diligence. Orholm's will be done.
Her body filled with sparkling yellow light. The green was a disconcertingly, if appropriately, curvaceous woman who looked Kip hard in the eye. That helped as she disrobed. He thought she might slap his head off if he looked at her generous... Oops.
Casting off lust, I am self-control, she said. Orholm's will be done.
The blue disrobed.
Casting off envy, I am kindness, she said softly. Orholm's will be done.
The superviolet was the last man, and he was enormously muscular.
Casting off pride, I am humility, he said in a booming voice. Orholm's will be done.
As one, they brought their hands down and pointed them at Kip's feet. Sprays of pure color blasted the black circle he stood on, It began to rumble and rattle beneath his feet. Then, abruptly, the disk of rock began sinking into the floor, and Kip with it. In moments, Kip was down to his butt, but the hole was too narrow. His fat caught on the sharp sides of the floor. He had to shimmy just to fit, and as the hole deepened, either his stomach or his butt was pressed against a wall.
"Raise your right hand," the superviolet said.
As Kip did, swallowing convulsively, he saw a rope dropping all the way from a ceiling so high above that he couldn't see past the glare of its brightness. The superviolet caught the rope and put the knotted end in Kip's upraised hand.
"Pull the rope, and it ends," the man said.
He had something akin to kindness in his voice. Then Kip was fully in the hole and still going down. He stopped below the floor. The light, high above in the testing chamber, went out. Kip could see nothing. He tried to take a deep breath, but the chamber was so tight he couldn't even draw a full breath.
There were whispered voices above him. "Deez, will you run this test for me?"
A man's voice replied, awkward.
"I've never run one before, my lord. You know, I think we set the tube too narrow. He's fat. He could suffocate."
"He's the prism's bastard."
"So? He's not here."
"So accidents happen. But I can't be here when they do. The prism knows I hate him. He doesn't know you. So if an accident happens on your watch..."
Kip couldn't hear the rest because water started pouring over his head. Cold. First a drivel, then a steady stream. It ran down the back of his neck to where his back was pressed tight against the walls. The walls around him pulsed an intense blue. Dear Orholm, they were going to kill him to get back at his father. Just like Gavin had warned him. The water pooled around his middle. It was too fat for it to drain down to his feet. He sealed the whole tube. Kip's heart was pounding. The intense light emanating through the walls burned from blue down into green, through the whole spectrum in order, even through heat, and then faded into nothing again as the water reached Kip's neck. Up to his ear. He pushed his body hard against the side of the chamber, and a gap opened between his hip and the wall. The pooled water poured down to his feet, but it kept coming from above. For a few moments he was able to intermittently push against the wall and make it drain once more, but soon he was awash, nearly floating. He pushed against the wall again, and the water didn't drain at all. There was nowhere for it to go. The water rose once more to his left shoulder, which was trapped down even as his right was trapped up, then up to his neck, his left ear. He didn't notice when the walls pulsed superviolet, but then they passed through blue to green as the water rose to his chin, to yellow as it touched his lips, orange as it covered his lips. Was the water falling more slowly on his head now? He took deep breaths through his nose, wriggled to try to use his body's wedged-in position to climb higher in the tube, and found that there were straps above his shoulders keeping him down. This was insanity. Someone was trying to kill him. Kip had to ring the bell. His fingers were claws around the rope. He could try again when there wasn't a murderer around. No. Quitting meant being put out. It meant failing. There was barely time to take one last deep breath before the water covered Kip's nose. The falling water pelting his head abruptly ceased. Kip could imagine it now. He was so fat, he trapped the water. It wasn't supposed to be that high. We didn't put too much water in, he just panicked. You know, a child, trapped and afraid. He must not have even thought to pull the rope. So that was it. He either quit and shamed his father more than his very existence already did, or his father's enemies did their best to kill him. Holding his breath, his lungs just beginning to burn, there was a sudden, stark clarity to the world. Pull the rope, go home. But there was no home. So, pull the rope and go farm somewhere. Or stay, and maybe die. Fail here, and he failed his father and his mother. Fail here, and he was a failure forever. I'm not pulling the rope. The chamber went black. The water got hot from the sub-red light, but then even that faded. I don't like farming. Kip coughed out some of his air, laughing. The thought was so inane. But the pain rapidly squelched wry humor. He couldn't make his heart slow.
He couldn't stop his throat from swallowing convulsively, his chest from pumping on nothing. I'm not pulling the rope, damn you. I'm not pulling the rope. Something shifted. At first Kip thought it was the water pouring out, but it wasn't. The ground below him was rising, but the stops above his shoulders stayed in place, crushing him in place. The water, far from draining, simply rose up his raised arm. In moments, he squatted down, pushed against his own knees. It squeezed him, and he coughed, the last of his breath bubbling out. He was trying to hold on to nothing. Breathing the water in would be worse than breathing nothing at all. He knew it. He knew it, and yet his body overwhelmed him, and he sucked a breath in. The water was hot, sharp, acrid in his lungs. He gagged, hunched even tighter against his own knees, his body ripping itself apart. He coughed, and miraculously, water shot out of his mouth into air. Blessed, glorious, free, beautiful air. Gasping, spitting, retching, and still compressed into a ball, Kip breathed. He could breathe. Mostly. His knees hurt from being squashed tighter than his not-so-flexible joints would allow. His back hurt, his ribs hurt, but or Holland, the air was good. If only he could get a full breath. Nothing happened. It was still utterly black. Kip was sweating now. He was packed in here. It was getting hotter by the second, and he was still dripping wet. The colours flashed past him through the whole spectrum again. So that's how it was. They saw that he wasn't going to quit, so they weren't going to give him another chance with the colours. It didn't matter. I'm not pulling the rope. I'm not pulling the rope, Kip shouted. Or tried to shout. He wasn't very loud, with only a half a breath. In response, the floor rose even more, crushing him harder against the stays on his shoulders. Kip screamed. He sounded like a coward. He couldn't even push back against the stays. His knees were bent too far to get him any leverage. If he just pulled on the rope a little, he could get a breath, and then he could go on fighting. No. Kip deliberately relaxed his fingers, his arm. He concentrated on breathing. Tiny, quick little breaths. It was enough. It would be enough. He was making it enough. A succession of colours blurred past. Kip didn't care. Was he supposed to do something? What? Draft? Right. Go bugger yourselves. The pressure eased suddenly and the floor dropped. Then the walls eased wider. Kip almost fell, but after a moment his rubbery legs were able to take his weight. The walls pulled back farther, farther. He tried to take a wider stance, but there was nothing beyond his little disc except air. Reaching one hand out, Kip couldn't feel the walls at all. A breeze blew across his skin, giving him the sensation that he was standing on some high place. It had to be an illusion, though. He was in the middle of the school. No way was there a big hole here. Colours flashed through distant walls, illuminating the chamber for a brief, terrifying moment. Kip stood over an abyss. His disc was the tiny round top of a pillar. A pillar standing alone in the middle of nothingness. The walls were 30 paces away. The ceiling over his head had a single hole through which only his hand was poking. Wind buffeted him, and Kip felt his grip go white-knuckled on the rope. He clamped his eyes shut, but then he couldn't tell if he was swaying with the wind or against it, or staying still. His heart was beating so hard he could hear his own pulse in his ears between gasping breaths. He screamed words, but he didn't even know what they were. After an eternity, the walls came back. They closed firmly around him, but comfortably now, and he felt a surge of relief. He'd made it. He'd passed. He hadn't given up. He hadn't pulled the... Something touched his leg. What was that? It curled around his ankle, twisted around his calf. A snake. Kip looked up and some many-legged thing dropped on his face. He reached a spastic hand up to sweep a spider away, but felt a manacle snap over his wrist and pull his left arm away, lock it into place. He tried to kick the snake away from his feet. Snap, snap. Shackles closed around his feet and yanked them wide apart. Kip screamed. The spider fell into his mouth. Before he even knew what he was doing, Kip bit down fiercely on it, crushing it in his teeth, sour goo squirting into his mouth. He screamed again, sheer defiance. Something landed in his hair. Dozens of slithering things roped around his feet, climbed his legs. He was going crazy.
"I'm not pulling the rope!" he shouted. "You bastards! I'm not pulling the rope!"
Kip convulsed. Or Hollum have mercy. His whole body was covered with loathsome things. He was weeping, screaming, and salvation lay in his hand. There was nothing wrong with farming. No one would hold failure against him. He didn't need to see these people ever again, and what did he care what they thought of him anyway? The whole game was stacked against him. He was finished. It was over. With an inhuman cry, Kip took the rope, with all his loathing and fury and despair rising in him, totally overwhelming him, failure calling his name, and threw it out of the hole. He sank against the wall, burying his face in the rock, crying. Colors flashed past once more, but the snakes and spiders didn't go. They covered his body. Still, the oppressive darkness continued. Something heavy and hairy landed on his back. Little claws stabbed him through his shirt, a rat. Then one on his thigh. Another landed on his head, scratching him as it slid off his wet hair. Kip froze. Fear like lightning flashed through his entire body. He was in a cupboard, helpless, starving, parched. He shivered uncontrollably. His motion disrupted the nasties and something bit him. He yelped, humiliated, furious. He twisted. More prickly bites, stinging bites, savage bites covered his arm, his legs, his groin, his back. Kip thrashed, throwing himself against one wall and then the other, trying to crush the beasts. Rats were climbing up his body on every side, and they refused to let go. He was weeping. He was so ashamed. There was something about the spider he'd bitten. It was too much. He couldn't take it anymore. He was finished. Kip couldn't stop himself. He reached for the rope. He was a failure, a shame, a fat, blubbering coward, a nothing. He felt the rope pressed back into his hand. "Here you go, Tubby," a satisfied voice whispered. "The taste, Kip. The taste was wrong," a kind voice said. What the woman had said didn't quite register. They were all over him. Kip pulled the rope. Failure. A distant clang, high overhead. At once the stinging ceased. Every slithering, crawling, clinging, stinging thing evaporated, disappeared. They weren't real. They hadn't been real rats. Kip should have known from the spider he'd bitten. Would have known if he hadn't been such a coward. That goo inside hadn't been guts. It had been Luxin. It was all illusions, fake, fears. He'd been tricked. He'd failed. As the platform rose, Kip's brain, no longer fogged with terror, realized what the woman had called him. Tubby. It was what Ram used to call him. Kip died a little. He'd proved Ram right. Again. As he emerged, though, the men and women were now dressed in festive robes of their own colors. Dazzling sapphire blues, emerald greens, diamond yellows, ruby reds. They appeared jubilant.
"Congratulations, supplicant,"
Mistress Varidos said, coming to join the circle. Kip stared at her, dumbfounded.
4 minutes and 12 seconds. You shall be very proud. I'm sure your father will be.
She was speaking some language Kip didn't understand. Proud? He'd failed. He'd shamed himself, shamed his father. He'd given up. The rage and frustration that had been building up suddenly had nowhere to go, leaving him feeling stupid.
"I failed," Kip said.
"Everybody fails," the incredibly muscular Superviolet said. "You did great. 4 minutes 12. I only lasted 1 minute 6.
"I don't understand," Kip said.
The nymphish yellow laughed.
"That's how the test is designed. We all failed."
They surrounded him. Men pounding him on the back, women touching his arms or shoulder, all congratulating him. It was a bit intoxicating to be so wholeheartedly welcomed by people who were so beautiful. Now that his brain was working again, he noticed that they hadn't necessarily chosen men to represent the old gods and women for the goddesses. Was that because they'd come so far that it simply didn't matter anymore, or was it deliberate disrespect.
"Is it true?"
Kip asked Mistress Varidos, who had stood back some lest the jostling crowd knock her over.
"Everyone fails?"
She smiled.
"Almost everyone. It's not to see if you can make it through the test. It's to see what kind of a person you are. And fear widens your eyes. Those colours you saw flashing past were the real test. Those will tell us what you can draft. Are you ready to see your results?"
"Wait, almost everyone?
Who doesn't fail?"
Kip asked. The jubilant men and women quieted. The old woman said,
"The only person in my lifetime who didn't take the rope was..."
Gavin. Kip knew it. Of course. His father had been the one man who did what no one else could do, what no one else had ever done. Kip had failed him.
"Your uncle," the mistress said.
"My uncle, Gavin, or my uncle Dazen?" Apparently registering his confusion, she said,
"Your uncle Dazen Guile, who nearly destroyed our world. Good footsteps, not to follow, hm?"
She was speaking that other language again. After all Kip had seen Gavin do, it was Gavin's brother who'd passed.
4 minutes is wonderful, Kip, but that's just bragging rights. Are you ready to see your colours?"
Chapter 44 Liv dropped into a curtsy, glad for the excuse to break eye contact with the prism. When she straightened, Gavin Gull was looking at her critically. Obviously she'd been right. Not many women answered his summonses in their work clothes and no cosmetics. "It's been a long time since I've seen a proper Tyrian curtsy," the prism said.
"After your armies left, there weren't many women left to curtsy."
"How may I serve you, High Lux Lord Prism?" Liv asked instead.
"Lord Prism is sufficient," Gavin said.
"Thank you, Lord Prism."
He was obviously weighing her, thinking. But thinking what? Whatever else that wretched woman Aglaia Krassos had done, she'd made Liv think of the prism as Gavin Guile, a man and a good-looking one at that. His eyes were, quite literally, the most entrancing eyes in the entire world. Magister, Liv. Tutor. Lord. Lux Lord. Noble. General. Twice as old as you. Way too old for you. Not a broad-shouldered, muscular man, just another magister. You can go to hell, Aglaia Krassos. "Have you chosen who you want to be your magister in yellow?" he asked.
"Thank you."
"See, I'm a disciple, purely academic, a child in comparison to him, hopelessly young and ignorant." She pursed her lips. "Honestly, I'd like to study under Mistress Tawenza Goldeneyes."
She could barely believe she dared say it out loud. The woman only took 3 disciples a year, and she already had 3. The 3 best yellow disciples in the Chromaria. Gavin laughed.
"That prickly she-bear?"
"A bold choice. She's the best, and she probably won't hate you as much as you think she does for the first year. I'd have you send my compliments to her when I assign her a 4th student, but she'd doubtless take it out on you. Consider it done. How are your apartments?" She paused. It was almost a personal question. "No, he's simply worried." "No, not worried. He's checking that his orders have been carried out. Generals do that sort of thing."
"They're better than anything I thought I'd ever have, Lord Prism. And the clothes? I used to have 3 dresses. Now I've got more than 50, and my worst is nicer than my old Sunday best."
"Wait. Maybe clothes weren't the best topic."
"And yet you decided to come in this," Gavin said, noticing. "Oops." His voice didn't intone disapproval. If anything, there was a thin thread of amusement. But his face didn't give her any expression to know if he was irritated. She should have listened to that slave, Mauricio. It wouldn't have killed her to freshen up a little. He glanced past her, and she followed his gaze, but the room was empty except for the 2 of them, and there were no unusual decorations on the walls, just the normal testing crystal.
"You said to come at my earliest convenience."
She couldn't keep a defensive tone out of her voice.
"I thought you'd not want to be kept waiting."
That was better. Nicely assertive, Liv.
"I think you'll do perfectly."
"Lord Prism?"
"You're perfect because you refuse to be impressed, Oliviana. I like that. It
I wouldn't exactly say I'm not impressed. He grinned.
You say, interrupting me. And proving his point. Liv decided to shut up, maybe differentiating herself from all the other women who came here and were unsuccessful in their attempts to seduce Gavin, had not been a good plan. It seems every time I summon a woman between the ages of 13 and 60, she comes dressed like a Hrothgari courtesan, either overly eager or completely terrified, like I run a brothel up here.
Oh, or Hollum strike me. What if I've done the one thing that makes me more attractive to him? You're Gavin Gile, Liv said.
Like that explained everything. It did. Not only would snaring the prism totally change a woman's own life, but it would change her entire family's life. Immediately, and for generations to come, and for the better. Add gorgeous and virile to prism, which already meant powerful, respected, and rich, and Liv had no doubt that hemlines soared and necklines swooped. It was a wonder that women didn't come to the prism naked. How much would Anna have worn if the prism had summoned her? On second thought, Liv didn't want to think about that. Yes, I am, Gavin said, smirking as if at some private joke. And I need your help, Oliviana. Liv swallowed. The truth was, he could ask anything, and there was no way she could say no.
Liv, please.
Right. Gavin cleared his throat. Why is he clearing his throat? He feels awkward. Does he feel awkward starting an affair with a girl half his age? Gavin glanced over Liv's shoulder again. A number of years ago, it feels like quite a number of years ago, I have a nephew. His mother was Tyrian. I want you to tutor him. It might make him feel more comfortable to learn from another Tyrian. I know you Tyrians don't have it easy. What do you say? Liv spluttered. A nephew? A tutor? Kip? Of course. Or Hollum. She'd gone completely the wrong direction. Idiot. The prism hadn't even been thinking anything remotely. Well, of course, Lord Prism. Is there... Why do... What was she saying? She'd already been impertinent enough. Asking the wrong question about a man's bastard might be a good way to ruin everything.
What color is he gifted with?
She only remembered at the last second to say he and not Kip. She wasn't supposed to know Kip was the prism's bastard at all. I would make a lousy spy. Green. Possibly blue. He's being initiated right now.
Right now?
Liv asked. The year's initiations had been completed long ago. Liv had never heard of someone being initiated at any other time of year.
How long has he been here?
He arrived yesterday.
And he's being initiated already? Liv asked.
Poor Kip. Gavin glanced behind her again. This time she knew what he was looking at. Throughout the tower, for reasons Liv had never comprehended, there were plain crystals set into the walls. For the whole year they simply sat and sparkled, dully refracting whatever light they caught from their surroundings, but during initiations at the beginning of each year they glowed brilliantly. As the supplicants passed through the thresher, invariably there was the wash of one colour after another as each test progressed, the same wash each supplicant saw. As soon as they drafted, the crystal turned a brilliant hue in whatever colour they drafted. For Liv, it had been superviolet first, then yellow weakly. The whole time Liv had been here, the prism had been watching to see how his bastard son was doing. Come to think of it, if the test had been going on since the first time Gavin Gile had glanced behind Liv, it was taking a really long time. Usually it took less than a minute. They both turned to look at the crystal. What did the testers say when they lowered you into the thresher? Gavin asked.
He said something about the only good rebel being a dead rebel, and how he still owed my father blood, Liv said.
The point had been, as it always was, to scare the person being tested. Fear made the eyes dilate. Fear made a supplicant draft to the utmost of her abilities. It also helped even the most arrogant young lady or lordling begin their studies with a bit of humility.
How about you?
Liv asked. Neither of them turned from the crystal. Something about my brother, Gavin said. Turned out to be more right than they knew.
I'm sorry, Liv said.
She wasn't sure if she was apologizing for asking, for the tester, or for the real-life nightmare Gavin had gone through later in having to kill his own brother. I never liked that part, scaring them. The chamber is terrifying enough, and the thought of failing is scary enough. They don't have to make supplicants think they're really going to die. It breaks people. It breaks children. Liv had never thought about it that way. The Thresher just was. Everyone went through it. It was inextricable from drafting, from the Chromeria. If nothing else, every drafter had the Thresher in common.
The noble girls all knew what was coming, Liv said, unlike the rest of us. They knew the test itself wouldn't hurt them, so that bit of talking outside the test was the only thing that made them afraid. Because even if they'd been warned, hearing a tester who claims to belong to your enemy's family saying that accidents happen is terrifying.
"Hadn't thought of that," Gavin said. "All my friends were nobles. I thought everyone knew what was coming." "Of course you did. It's just another way the Chromeria's stacked to favor your kind." Gavin cleared his throat. "Liv, my son might be special, really gifted. We'll find out presently, but I wouldn't be surprised if he's a polychrome. He's Tyrian, his mother just died. He's going to face false friends and unearned enemies just for being my son. He won't fit in anywhere, and yet people are going to be watching him all the time. If he's truly powerful on top of that, he could turn into a monster. He wouldn't be the first in my family to handle great power poorly. The gift isn't a pure gift, you know."
"What do you want me to do?" Liv asked.
Was she really going to be tutoring the prism's son? Bastard son, but still. She felt like a huge weight had been lifted off of her. The prism was just the prism. Well, maybe there was no such thing as being just the most powerful man in the world, but he was a lord to whom she owed service. Normal service. Something not terribly hard, given how completely he'd changed her life. "Maybe he'll be a monochrome. Probably will be. I'm getting ahead of myself," Gavin said.
"But if he's not?"
"You've got to let me know what your expectations are, or I'm going to fail, and then you'll be mad at me for that."
Typical nobleman.
Liv felt good that she was able to be irritated. She was regaining her bearings. "Pretend he's normal, in all ways. I know he'd figure it out pretty quickly if we stay, but I'm going to take him away from here as soon as I possibly can. Until then, give him some normalcy. If he makes you mad, yell at him. Smack his knuckles with a stick if he misbehaves, you understand? But if he masters something difficult, pretend it's good but nothing out of the norm. I want him to know that those who matter aren't going to be impressed by who his father is or how much he can draft."
"And who are these people?" Liv asked sarcastically.
She hadn't really meant to say it out loud, but Gavin was being ridiculously idealistic. Of course who he was and how much he could draft mattered. Maybe when you were born on the top of the mountain, you could pretend the mountain didn't matter, but those who climbed it and those born at its base who could never climb at all knew differently. "Me and Orholm," Gavin said, ignoring her tone. "If we're the only ones whose approval he cares about, he's got a chance." Liv didn't know if that was the most arrogant or the most profound thing she'd ever heard. Maybe both. Whatever else it did, though, it reminded her who and what Gavin was. By Orholm's scowling brow, she'd been glibly sarcastic to the prism, the man closest in all the world to Orholm himself. And thank Orholm that Liv had turned down that awful woman, even if it was going to cost her dearly. Spying on the prism himself, it was practically sacrilegious. As bad as Liv's stupidity and awkwardness and horrifying sliver of infatuation was, how awful would it have been to be a traitor, too? She swallowed.
"I'm sorry, Lord Prism. I was out of—"
Gavin raised a hand and stood abruptly. Liv glanced at the crystal but saw nothing. The crystal hadn't changed. She looked over at Gavin in time to see the prism blanch. Then his face was lit up like the sun had just come out from behind the blackest clouds. A wash of colours flashed through his skin, and he threw out a hand toward the crystal. A crackling, shimmering tube of Luxin shot from his hand and stuck to the crystal on the opposite wall like an iridescent spiderweb on fire. More and more gushed out of the man, pushing deep into the crystal. And then, as abruptly as he started, Gavin stopped. A moment later, the crystal glowed a brilliant jade green, and then a less intense blue. Gavin sighed with relief.
What was that?
Liv asked.
A secret,
Gavin barked. He gestured and Liv felt a gust of cold wind and heard the windows drop heavily into their slots.
Come here,
the prism ordered. His body filled with every colour in the rainbow and beyond. A rope of green luxin, wrapped around a chain of yellow-infused blue, ran from his hand.
Now go. I have to be there first to contain this, and he's going to need you.
In a daze, Liv hurried over to the prison. She didn't even know what he was talking about.
Get on my back, he said.
What?
On my back, now. Hold on tight.
She jumped on his back. His body was unnaturally hot from the sub-reds he was holding along with every other color. What was he doing? She looked at the chain he was holding again. Then he turned and faced the void outside his window. She squeaked and held on with a death grip.
Mother, I...
the prism said.
What?
Liv asked, loosening her grip around his neck.
Not that tight,
he growled. Even as she apologized, bands of luxin whipped around her body, holding her tight against him. Gavin took a run toward the window and leapt. Liv's view at first was only of the luxin spooling out of Gavin's hand like spider's silk, perfectly matching the rate at which they were falling. She realized she had no idea how far exactly they would have to fall to get to the level of the threshing chamber, or how Gavin would know when to stop them. For that matter, how did he mean to get back into the tower from the outside? Hope someone left a window open?
Oh, dear old Hollum, they were falling an awfully long time.
Liv's eyes disobeyed her and jumped from the luxin above to the ground below. It was rushing up at them with incredible speed. Then she was crushed into Gavin's back as he solidified the rope. The pressure threatened to sweep her off of him and straight into the courtyard. They whipped around backward, and she saw the rope chain spooled out to the distant top of the prison's tower, and the tower itself was looming bigger and bigger as they swung back toward its sheer, unbroken face. Three sharp jerks pushed her and Gavin backward, but with nowhere near enough force to slow them down. Briefly, Liv saw three missiles streaking out from Gavin's outstretched left hand toward the tower in front of them. She didn't see what the missiles did, because whatever else they accomplished, with Gavin shooting them out of his left hand while his right held the rope, he absorbed the recoil with his left arm. So as soon as the missiles were out of his hand, Gavin and Liv were sent spinning sharply widdershins. Glass and stone exploded on every side around Liv. She was sliding along a floor, zipping straight and smooth for a fraction of a second, abruptly cut away from the prism. Then something caught the hem of her skirt. Her momentum and the friction with the floor yanked it up hard, and then her bare skin squeaked on naked stone. She flopped over sideways and rolled a few times. When she stopped against the wall, all she could think was that she couldn't believe she was still alive. There were half a dozen drafters in the suddenly breezy hallway looking at the prism and her in disbelief. The prism was already up, giving sharp orders.
Why is my butt cold?
Liv followed the drafter's stairs and looked down. Her skirt was bunched around her waist from the slide, exposing her to all the world. She squeaked, yanked her skirt down, and jumped to her feet.
You, get Luxlord Black. Tell him I want this repaired. Today. Go immediately. You, take the names of everyone in this hall and everyone in the testing chamber,
the prism was saying. Liv, seeing everyone's attention was on the prism, shifted her hips. She hadn't noticed until after she jumped up, but her butt cheeks had been cold because her underclothes had been yanked up too. Now they were cleaving the moon in a serious way. She shimmied, trying to fix her underclothes without fishing after them with a hand.
Oliviana, what are you doing?
The prism asked. Liv froze, transfixed.
Never mind, stay here. I'll call for you in a moment.
Gavin opened the door to the testing chamber and slipped inside. All the drafters in the hall, including one of the best-looking young magisters in the whole Cremeria, Payam Navid, turned to look at Liv, obviously wondering why she was so important, and killing her chance to quickly tug her underclothes down. Not having any idea what she was going to find or what the prism was going to expect of her, she smiled nervously at the young magister. Chapter 45
Gavin moved quickly, hearing the old bichrome say, "Are you ready to see your colours?" to Kip.
"I know I am," Gavin said. "Mistress Faridos, may I—"
Family members of supplicants weren't allowed in the testing chamber for fear that it would lead to cheating.
The rule, at least theoretically, even applied to the prism. There's a reason theory and practice are two different words. I wasn't even aware that you began your testing. How long did they say you lasted? Gavin asked.
4 minutes, I guess, Kip said.
4:12, the old mistress said. Gavin physically stopped. It had seemed like a long time up in his room, but he'd supposed it had only seemed long. 4 minutes was astounding. Passing had only taken him 5. Mrs. Faridos drew close to Gavin and whispered,
"There was some irregularity that I think you should know about."
Gavin smiled at Kip. "Well done. We'll just be a moment." He came aside, leaving Kip with the men and women who were asking him which part he thought was hardest, how he'd managed to hold out so long, and generally treating him like the centre of the world. It was pretty intoxicating for a young drafter, and it was supposed to be. Grinning, Gavin walked toward the tester's table with Mistress Faridos. They came to stand right over the stone table. A black samite cloth was spread over a hole in the middle of the table. The testing stone would be right in there. Gavin tried to remember exactly how it was positioned. He'd only get one shot at this. "What was the irregularity?" he asked. The samite blocked out any outside light that would interfere with the testing stone. The old woman exhaled slowly.
"He threw the rope out of his hand at about 3:30. Before I could stop her, one of the women put it back in his hand."
"Are you joking?" Gavin said.
"They sent the beautiful ones for the testing. Half of them barely have the brains to remember their lines, much less remember some of the more obscure rules governing situations that have never arisen in living memory. Even Dazen didn't throw the rope aside."
"Which one did it?"
"The green."
Of course it was the green, wild, unpredictable, chafing at the slightest restriction. "Get her over here." The green tester saw the mistress's summons and walked right over. All the testers were beautiful, and if being light-skinned was a detriment on the battlefield, it was favoured for this and a few other ceremonies. The visual effect of a man or woman whose skin was green or blue or red was more muted the darker their natural skin tone. Even the Pareans chose coastal, lowland, or mixed-blood countrymen to represent them in this ceremony. This woman was Hrothgari, and light-skinned even for them. She moved with the easy grace of a dancer. Her thin green robe, thrown on during the ceremony so that all the testers would be clad in their colours when the supplicant emerged, which might be only 10 or 15 seconds after their testing began, was in her case open deep between her large breasts. She walked up eagerly, throwing her hair back, back straight, standing just on the other side of the table. The nudity and near-nudity of some of the ceremonies were shrouded in religious and cultural symbolism that made them almost non-erotic. Almost, because no matter how high-minded you might be, you couldn't completely ignore the fact that you were looking at someone who was naked and astoundingly attractive. But the parties afterward, especially at initiations, were always a grey area. Everyone beautiful, everyone half-clad, everyone with a fresh memory of everyone else, stark naked, the atmosphere jubilant, the wine flowing freely, and the sombre ceremonialism suddenly removed. This green knew exactly what she was doing. Gavin was taller than the woman, so he could barely help but stare down her barely closed robe. Instead, he looked at her heart-shaped face, hazel eyes, the pupils barely haloed in green. She looked familiar. "Over here," he said, pointing next to him, between himself and Mistress Faridos. She stepped around the stone table to where he'd pointed, but closer in than necessary.
"Who are you?"
he asked, his voice cool.
"My name's Tisis,"
she said, her smile showing off great dimples. "Tisis what?"
"Oh,"
she said, as if she didn't have a thought in her head.
"Tisis Malagos."
"What happened, Tisis?" he asked, pretending not to recognize the name. Her father and uncle had been his friends. That was his Dazens. They'd disappeared after the war, killed by bandits or enslaved by pirates, most likely. She had the family look. No doubt she hated him. She'd seen that Kip had a chance of passing the test, so she'd sabotaged him. Gutsy. Foolish and infuriating, but gutsy.
"The supplicant cheated,"
she said. He threw out the rope. I put it back in his hand.
You're not to touch the supplicant in any way during the testing. Is there something about that rule that's unclear?
I didn't touch him. Pardon me, High Lux Lord Prism. I put the rope back in his hand without touching his skin. I was trying to preserve the integrity of the test.
Malagos, Gavin said. You're Ulfgari, right?
Yes, Lord Prism.
Gavin looked at her flatly. When your own blessed satrap Rados crossed the Great River to fight the Blood Foresters, who outnumbered him 2-1, do you remember what he did?
He burned Rosanos Bridge behind his army, she said.
Was that cheating?
I don't follow, she said.
He burned the bridge so his men knew they couldn't flee. He gave them no way out. Every last man knew he had to win or die. It's where we get the expression, burning your bridges behind you.
But I saw him reaching for the rope, she complained weakly.
She swallowed, suddenly unnerved to have contradicted the prism to his face. And you gave it back to him?
Of course.
So you would have built a new bridge behind Blessed Satrap Rados?
Of course not, that would be...
And doomed him. How long did you last before you pulled the rope? Gavin asked. She flushed.